Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we have a far-ranging conversation with Jen Webb about poetics and the writer's life, plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. I'm Peter Searles. What goes on in the mind of a poet? Well, today and next week, we get a look into the busy, expansive thinking of one poet, Jen Webb. Jen Webb is a much-published writer and cultural theorist, and Dean of Graduate Studies and Director at the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research at the University of Canberra. She writes poetry, researches creative practice, and makes and exhibits artists' books. Her non-poetry books have such titles as Researching Creative Writing and Art and Human Rights, Contemporary Asian Contexts. When Kimberly K. Williams spoke to Jen Webb about coming in to speak with us on Poetry on the Radio, Webb was thinking a lot about everyday poetry. That's where the conversation began.
Thank you for reminding me. Because after I said to you, I want to talk about, it's all about the everyday, I immediately thought, what on earth does that mean? So I've been doing some thinking about that the last little while. And it's not as though there's not a lot of everyday poetry in the whole corpus of poetry. I mean, Sappho's work is about small everyday things, the ribbon in your hair, the look of the grass. On the other hand, most of the other Greek poets were doing you know, those great epics about gods and heroes. So that's not everyday. And this kind of rolls up, if I'm thinking about it broadly speaking, and this is casual thinking, I haven't actually gone and dug stuff out. But I do know that Hebrew poetry, most of which you find in the Bible, the Psalms, for instance, is a lot of that is about the divine. Mm. It's important stuff, you know, gravitas. But the Song of Solomon is all about, you know, love and passion and sex. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of more everyday as well. But it is actually quite rich people having love, passion and sex. The everyday, the idea of everyday poetry probably comes in a bit over a century ago. At the point, I'm talking about Western poetry now, which, at a point at which the artists started breaking away from the academy and doing what they wanted to do. And very often that was looking at ordinary things, everyday things, the quotidian. Imagism is full of this, the modernism is full of this.
Right.
But where I kind of depart, is that's not really what I'm thinking about either, because what they were doing, what they aimed to do was look at everyday and ordinary things and show, make them meaningful. And I think they're meaningful already. And that's kind of where I depart from them. I'm moving more across, I suppose, to a phenomenological idea that we are all, humans are part of this whole network of everything that's in the world, and we are not more important, and it's not up to us to attribute meaning. The meaning is there already. And you know, I think about some eco-poetry, and I mean, of course, ecology is what's on all our minds, right? But there is a lot of eco-poetry, which is, I think that I will never see a poem lovely as a tree. And I don't want to go, it to sound like that. What I'm thinking more is that a tree is a tree for itself. It doesn't care about us.
Mm.
It's doing tree things for tree people, tree community. And humans come in there and we attribute meaning. But they have meaning already. They have value already. Where I'd really love to go more and more in poetry is honouring that the beingness of things that aren't human and things that are human. Everyday people really matter. So trying to cut out the judgment and look at things with kinder eyes, but also William James, 19th century psychologist, one of the fathers of psychology, and he did a lot of work on what he called selective attention, which is now very well known in the literature. And he says, millions of things surround me every day which I cannot perceive because I don't see them, because I don't attend to them. They are outside my point of attention. Mm. So I don't even see that they're there. And for me, this idea of every day is that we're trying to see more what is there beyond the preconceptions of our selective attention. So stopping and looking and just staying with things a bit more.
So would you be willing to read a poem that you feel really explores that or in some way shows that?
I don't know that my poems actually do show, but it's what I'm trying to think, I suppose, in the making of a poem.
Okay.
There's one in here. This is Moving Targets, which came out a few years ago. 2020, maybe, I think.
This Moving Targets is recent work press?
It's a recent work press book, 2018. So it's quite an old book now. And when I was producing, when I was starting to do the poems that were going to become this book, my daughter was diagnosed with cancer.
Mm.
And so I thought a lot about the things we don't see, the thingliness, the perceptual haptic quality of everyday objects in life, as well as this massive anxiety So I deflected my anxiety by thinking about stuff. But mm-hmm. I went and spent a bit of time look after the kid or the little boy while she was having surgery. And she lives in Melbourne, and so you have the surgery in Melbourne in the city hospital. And then they shoot you out to what's called the Repat Hospital in Heidelberg for recovery. And I was really quite obsessed with that hospital because it's so derelict. The middle part of it is the refurbed Repat Hospital, but it was a World War II hospital. They'd bring the wounded soldiers in, or the wounded service personnel in from the Pacific War mostly, I understand, put them on trains, and this slow train would crank its way out, boom, 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 through Melbourne to the Repat Hospital where they would recover or die. And the hospital is full of really kitsch, what to my mind are very kitsch things, you know, statues of soldiers looking with their hand up over the head, looking dramatic, and Australian flags flapping, and Lest We Forget is all over the place. And I spent, when I wasn't sitting with Hannah, my daughter, in the ward, I was outside walking through this strange maelstrom and looking in the windows of derelict buildings, in one of which there was a green cow. I mean, it must have been important for somebody at some point. So that little thing, I'll read this. It's quite a long poem, with several parts. I'll just read the first one, which is actually at the Repat Hospital, Heidelberg. And the first part of this poem is called The Night Watch. In the corridor, nurses are singing along to the radio. The old man by the window coughs, slips back into snoring, coughs. Strange silence. You can hear a spider preparing her new web in a corner where no one cleans, and ghosting in the crackle of light glancing off crosses in the memorial garden in the Lest We Forget, We Have All Forgotten. You, by the door, listening to the night, to its three-part harmony, the lilt of voices, the murmur of skin as it shifts across bones, the drip of fluids. This is the time the curtains are drawn, sheets bundled from the room, the bodies removed. This is when the demobbed return, those we see only when the light falls just so. They walk through these old halls, touching new instruments with astounded hands. The room is dark, but if you step out boldly, small lights stutter up to illuminate deadfalls and pits. There will be better news. You can count on it. And this time our hearts will unbreak.
One thing I've noticed in reading many of your works, but especially sentences from the archives, is that you tend to put poems in sequence or in parts. Could you speak to that a little?
I can. I tend to write short poems, as you may have noticed. And some years ago, I had an Australian Research Council funding to investigate poetry and poets. What constitutes excellence? What makes a poet? And with Paul McGee and Kevin Brophy and a couple of internationals. And so I interviewed a lot of poets. Between us, we interviewed 80-something, and there were a million words of transcripts, if you want numbers. Wow. It was a big project. But one of the poets that I interviewed is Alistair Patterson, who's based in New Zealand. And he has been for a very, very long time. He's no longer doing this job. He was the editor of New Zealand Poetry. And he talked a lot about how he spent his time as an editor actually helping bring up young poets and working with them, actually editing and training them to do better work. But he also showed me a couple of his books, and they were quite large format, so A4 format, and it was one long, long, long sequence. Mm. It's one poem in several parts. And I said, obviously, duh, I can't write long poems. He said, nobody writes long poems. You write short poems. We put them together. Go home and try doing that. And that's sort of what I was doing. So the poems that are in sequences didn't start in sequences. Mm. They started as something I was thinking about quite a lot. And I wrote quite a few poems, right. When I came to, you know, you print out your poems, you look at them on screen, you collate them and think, actually, I think those go together. And that becomes a sequence.
So it's completely non-linear.
Completely non-linear.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay.
I'm not a very linear thinker, so it's probably just as well it works like that. Yeah.
There was one multi-part poem in Moving Targets that I sense there might be a story behind and I wanted to ask about. It's Blanche and Henry.
Oh, there's a lovely story behind that.
Oh, good. I was hoping so.
Yeah. So my partner's a curator. He's a museum studies person. And after he retired from 25 years in the business, he decided he would start collecting objects that have no provenance. And, you know, because he's a trained curator, he can see things that are really old. He knows that they're old and he knows that they're interesting. They're beyond. So he crawls around op shops and auction houses. And I came home one day and he said, I've got a present for you. And he brought out a small volume of Leaves of Grass, Walt Whitman's book. So it's little. It was A6, pretty much size, hardbound, very, very faded green fabric cover. And when I opened it, it said, Dear Henry. And it was Blanche. She signed her name, Blanche M. Adams, at the bottom. And it was November 1914, which is a pretty serious time. World War One is just exploding. And she had clearly they were friends. It looked to me as though she wanted a lot more from the friendship than he did. And she kind of apologised in a rather offhand, joking way about overacting in the darkroom and spilling the fluids that they use, the developing fluids. And it was a sweet letter. It was a funny letter. It was witty. And it was also a little bit like, dude, you don't know what you're missing.
Yeah.
So John is my partner. He and I both got quite obsessed with Blanche. And we looked her up and we spent a lot of time. John traced her entire family history in Adelaide. She never married. We followed her all the way through to Melbourne. I went and photographed the houses that she lived in Carlton. She was a photographer by that stage. And she called herself an artiste in the census. And she ended up in Sydney teaching piano to children. Never married. Looked after her family. And that, for me, that all we had about her was that little frontispiece handwritten note that she'd written to Henry. And I was obsessed, obviously, with it. I photographed it, sent it around to all my friends in the Prose Poetry Project, and we had this efflorescence of writing about Blanche and Henry. And so there were about 8 or 9 of us at that stage, and then I had an exhibition of Blanche and Henry. I made some installation pieces, made a book of people's poems, put stuff up in the wall. And this is several years ago. I mean, that's 1918. This is, 2018 volume, and we're talking about it probably 4 or 5 years or so beforehand. And I still think about her a lot and the traces that people do and don't leave in history. Mm. She wrote several pieces for the local newspaper, and which are in Trove, and they were serious pieces. This is 1915, 16, writing a lot about women's rights, writing about the ludicrous nature of marriage, writing about trade union actions, writing against conscription. So she was a passionate activist and an artist, and she's not known. I've put it out on Facebook, I've asked friends, I've asked every Adamson I can find. No one is related to her. Mm. So she's disappeared into history, but she left that amazing trace of her being in a very battered, ordinary old copy of a very widely published book.
She's the perfect Doggerland, right? Because in that moment she reappears.
She went underwater, but she reappears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's her surname?
Adamson.
Adamson.
Like Robert, but it's not him, not his family.
Mm.
Yeah.
And was it that he was a photographer and then she became a photographer?
I think they were probably both photographers. He clearly had a studio. Haven't been able to trace him. There's a couple of people who could be him who didn't come back from the war that did have photographic studios, because photography was really burgeoning then. It was new, it was exciting, big equipment, dangerous chemicals.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think probably they became friends through that sort of photography. She might have been helping him in the darkroom, for all I know. He might have been helping her in her darkroom. But clearly, she's the one who knocked over the tray with the fluid and annoyed everybody. Yeah.
It's just amazing to me that, too, all of this is sort of set with Walt Whitman in the background. Yeah. You know, Leaves of Grass. That's not lost on me.
It's not lost on
right?
me.
Right? You said you had a whole installation and everything around this. But since this is really the first we're hearing about it, like, I'm thinking, this is a book.
Yes. I mean, you could do a lot more with it. Yeah. Actually, Paul Hetherington, who's one of our crowd, he also got excited by that. And he also wrote a sequence and sent them off to the Newcastle Poetry Prize. And he either won or I think he won it, actually, for that one. Because it's a tremendously evocative story.
Mm.
And it's a story that's so modern.
Yes.
You know, it's over 100 years ago. She's such a contemporary person. And Henry's the loser.
I wanted to make sure that we touched on is what you're talking about with Paul. And looking at your collection of creative work, how often you collaborate?
We have collaborated a lot. We don't as much anymore because we've kind of gone off in different directions to some extent.
Mm.
I'm not very interested in ekphrastic poetry, even though sometimes it pops up. Paul's very interested in it, for instance. He's interested in going back to lineated poetry. And I find line breaks terrifying. I don't understand them. Nobody's ever been able to explain to me in a satisfactory or convincing manner. And so I find if I just do prose poems, then I feel safe. And if they need air, I can open them up. I can push words apart from each other, lines apart from each other. But I think in terms of the box, the paragraph, I feel most at home there. And Paul certainly does like it too, but he also likes to do other things. But we have collaborated a lot.
Right.
We've done some quite big things together. We did a bilingual version with a colleague of ours who was Chinese and he was a trained translator and a poet. We did a bilingual version of Australian, contemporary Australian poems for the Chinese market.
There's also the book you did with Shay Hawk.
Yes.
And Flight Mode, 2020. And, so I can see that you're working with...
Yeah, that was kind of a different sort of collaboration. Mm-hmm. So Paul and I have often co-written or we've co-produced. Like one of the first books we did together was like my photographs of Canberra, deliberately ordinary, it was everyday Canberra. So even then I was interested in everyday. And Paul wrote poems in relationship to the photos. And that was for 2013, which was the centenary of Canberra's establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, they get those lovely soft cheeses that come in little round balsa wood boxes.
Yes.
So I got my partner to eat a lot of cheese. I love the boxes. And it occurred to me that the circles of the box are ideal for thinking about Canberra. So got a lot of those. And they can get bigger round balsa wood boxes that have bigger cheeses or cookies in them. So poor John had to just eat his way through gallons of food to produce all these boxes, which I saved for some time. And then I took my photos and I cut them in circles and put them inside the box. And Paul wrote his poems and I printed them on heavy-duty paper and then cut them in circles and put them. And then we had the installation, which was like the Longlo running through Canberra. That was kind of the shape of it, all these paired little round boxes. At the end of the exhibition, I wanted to burn them and Paul said I couldn't, so I saved them for a while. And we produced the book, a really nice book. I think it's a lovely book. They did a beautiful job of it, of the book of the photos and the poems. And then a gallery in US asked to have them and some other work. So, again, poor John, he does everything. He went through, because the balsa wood cracks and falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
And he went through and he fixed the broken boxes. He did conservation work on them. Mm-hmm. We sent them off to the States and they had the last fling. And now they're back in my office and I want to burn them. And I need to do it when Paul isn't looking, I think.
Why do you want to burn them?
Because I think it says there's a completion. And if I burn them, I'll have a little one. What I imagine doing is burning them all and having one more little balsa wood box with the ashes of them in it.
Oh, wow. Mm. Yeah. I mean, to some degree, that just makes me think of sort of that more Eastern, with a capital E, idea of impermanence. And, you know, we in the West, we really do tend to treat many things like they're fixed. But that's, I think, not necessarily so. It's only our perception.
Can I tell a little story?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
A couple of days ago, Jane Fong, who's one of the PhD students at my university, wrote to me and asked to ask a question. And she's working on women in leadership using a particular conception of how we engage with the world. And she'd just come across, just been to a workshop. She is Vietnamese, but she'd been to a workshop on Vietnamese conceptions of the world. And she said what she finds interesting is that there's this vision of the human being lying. You've got your head to the water and your feet to the mountain and your body, your belly, so face down, on the ground. And so she's looking at horizons of understanding.
Mm.
And what you understand when you're like that, and what you understand is that you're really up close against things. But it is only one way of looking. And for a rice-growing community that needs no water, you also have to stand up and shift your horizon of understanding and see art. And I think that's a lovely idea of you never stay in the one spot. You never just look at the same things. We move and we change. And the world changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been... I mean, I grew up in a very multicultural nation and a very brutal nation, mm-hmm. South Africa. But what you see there is that everybody sees things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And there was 21 languages being spoken and most people understood enough of them to get by.
Right.
So there was always change, always difference.
Right.
And I'm very taken with that. And I'm not taken with empire, the idea of empire, or the idea of a linear pattern of history.
Mm.
So I think, you know, that's why I really like those other ways of looking at stuff.
One of my questions reading through your work this week has to do with how willing and ready your poems are to use different points of view. You know, you might have several poems in the second person, and then suddenly there's a third person as she. And there's a shifting perspective a lot with that. And I wonder maybe if it comes from that.
It may do. I honestly don't know. I don't think consciously I must change perspective. And I do think about what voices are happening there and who's doing what to whom. You know how when you start writing poetry or prose, you write about yourself. So young poets tell all the anguish they've ever had, you know, and they bleed all over the stage. And as you get older or more experienced with it, your own life becomes quite irrelevant and you're more interested in looking at other people and other places and other activities. And I think once you do that, you don't know who the speaker is because it's not you anymore. It's not your immediate circle. So you kind of have to construct it. And I think the construction is, I'm probably trying to find rhythm, pattern, tonality, texture is what I'm really looking for.
I see.
Which perhaps may be why there's differing perspective, points of view brought in.
But I think the interesting, and I didn't think it was necessarily conscious, but I think that the effect of that is what you're saying. Sometimes you're lying down, sometimes you're sitting up, sometimes you're standing, as you're reading through your poems, right? We can never quite settle, even though what's around us is fairly every day. Peter and I were talking on the drive over about the bus poem, the series, the sequence. Do you want to share your observation on that?
Oh, just that we knew that we would be talking about poetry in the everyday. And when I thought of that, I immediately thought of that sequence of poems. Also, other ones came up as well. But we thought you can be dealing with the everyday, but then it always seems to take this leap into grander ideas, bigger concepts. And the sequence about waiting for the bus seemed to deal about death quite a bit.
Yes, Sandra Burr she was actually one of my PhD students too. And amazing woman, just terrific. And she did a beautiful PhD, wrote beautiful work, did poems, stories, intellectual essays and so on. And then she died. She had cancer and struggled through and then she was gone. And I really loved her and we were close together. We were working on an anthology. She was passionate about animals, working on an anthology of poems about animals. So she had quite a collection started and I haven't had the heart to carry on with it. So we did have a lot to do with each other and she died and we had the funeral. But you know how death stays with you quite a long time? And I was sitting at a bus stop, obviously, waiting for the bus. And I kept thinking about Sandra and I started jotting down notes. Because I think if you're a writer, if you're an artist of any sort, I think you manage your world by putting it into art. And once it's there, then it's a little bit safer. It can't bite you as much because it belongs over there now. And that's where those poems came from. And thinking about how tenuous is our grip on everything. I didn't deliberately think, oh, buses are coming and going, you know, like a cat, uncertainly, not coming on time, coming too early, letting people off or on. I think probably that is imagery there. I didn't mean it to be, just that I was waiting for the bus and it didn't come and I couldn't but think about Sandra. And by thinking about Sandra, of course, I was thinking about all the bits and pieces, the losses and the gains that we have through everyday encounters.
So that poem is from Sentences from the Archive, which is Recent Work Press, and 2016.
Yeah.
And it's in four parts, is that right? No, it's longer.
It was longer. It was actually longer yet, but I took some of them out.
Wow, so it's in eight parts. Mm. Would you read one of the parts?
Sure. So number six. So this is effectively stanza six, yeah. I am waiting for the bus. Three have wandered past, none of them mine. I should light a cigarette, an invocation to the gods. Silence swells between us. I never speak your name, but you are in everything I say. Actually, I might read a short one from Five Tastes. So again, I've talked about this mob of us who do prose poems, and in various ways we collate. And there are five of us who every year take a topic and split it in five ways. And we each write 21 prose poems on our bit of the topic and an artist statement, and we put them together into a book. So this is last year's, that we took Taste, and I chose Bitter. because I'm a bitter person. And also because I think bitter gets really bad press, because bitterness is one of the best tastes, really. Coffee.
Coffee. Broccoli. I drink my coffee black.
Yeah.
I love coffee black. Yeah. You're right, though. It does get bad.
This one is called Beyond Steenbras. And Steenbras is just north of Cape, going up the coast north from Cape Town. It's probably not north. It's probably going up to the right-hand side. So that'd be the east. East. And Steenbras, there's a big river gorge there. Beautiful, high, and it's high country. So you climb up out of Cape Town, go really up and up and up into the hills, and you can see all the way out to the horizon. It's just ocean. It's just great big ocean, nothing else beyond there. And we used to do that drive quite a lot as kids. So beyond Steenbras. You badly wanted to go to the shops with your friends, but no, it's a Sunday, which is to say family day. So you're piled into the car with your sisters for the long drive down through the suburbs to the high coast road, where your parents teach you to see what they see. Stopping the car, saying, "Look, we're at the edge of the world." Beyond the car, beyond the waters and the waves, the edge. There is nothing but deep ocean and three slow ships making their way over and down to what you can't see from here. Australia, the South Pole, outer space. It's lonely. You feel lonely in this world that is too broad and too empty, knowing you have nothing to say that it cares to hear. The car moves on, then stops again beside the lookout at the top of the pass. And Mum passes back fruit and sandwiches. And soon the baboons are there too, banging on the windows, all teeth and arse and la demands. Some Sunday, some goddamn day.
I think that is the perfect example of how your poetry, which I think is really understated, because it's grounded in the everyday. You start off with this thing that happens weekly, and the speaker is, it's boring. It's that regular. And then suddenly, somehow, we're in the universe. So you sort of inch and move your poems, inch and move us along, until suddenly the vista is massive and we see the big picture. I don't think that's easy to do. I think that's really gorgeous, and for some reason makes me feel hopeful.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
I'm glad you feel hopeful, because, I mean, I do, I quite often write poems that are really bleak, and Shane gives me a hard time about it, but I actually am quite hopeful.
You
I think
are.
The world's bleak, but that there's more to it than what we see.
On next week's episode of Poetry on the Radio, we'll continue our discussion with Canberra-based poet Jen Webb, beginning from this point, where she was about to say that sometimes choosing or altering one word of a poem can make a huge difference. I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. Congratulations to Theodore L., who is one of two winners of this year's Ann Elder Award, a prize for first publications which is administered by Poetry Australia. Theodore L. was honoured for Beginning in Sight, published in 2022 by Recent Work Press. The judges praised L.'s intricately elusive landscapes of loss, transformation and insight, rendered in assured, concise language. On Monday, May 29 at 7 p.m, that poetry thing at Smith's Alternative in Civic presents a big open mic to mark Reconciliation Day in the ACT. Coming soon at Smith's Poetry Events, on June 5, Jeff's Poetry presents Michael Sharkey and Natalie Cook. On June 12, that poetry thing presents Lyrebird Tanker Circle. And on June 19, Recent Work Reading presents Owen Bullock and Erin Scheel. Poetry on the Radio is produced on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Art Sound FM in Canberra, and is heard Sundays at 4:30 p.m, Mondays at 10:30 p.m, and online at artsound.fm. Look under the Programs tab. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monaghan. Special thanks to Annika Grant. The music on today's program is from Ayako Shinozaki's groundbreaking 1974 album, Music Now for Harp. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.